Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist, and we are waiting on Kate to join us. Hopefully she'll make it. If you're listening now, you're listening live, and we are so happy to have you on the show. Hi, Kate.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here as well.
Ooh, what a day.
What a week.
We're barely here.
Laura called me just before four desperately. You did remember, you didn't forget the show, did you? Yeah. I haven't quite adapted to this 4 o'clock on Sunday thing yet.
Well, now we'll move it to 6 o'clock on Sundays, and hopefully both of us will have our afternoon activities finished and we'll actually remember the show is on, and I'll start trying to call you a little earlier than 5 minutes until the show.
I think those things all help. I think you'll be better. So how are you, Laura?
I am really good.
Good.
Really, really good. And how about you?
I'm doing very well.
Well, good.
Settled down on
all
my
right.
house.
What'd you say?
I said I've settled down on my house for the time being, so that's good.
Well, good. I'm glad we're giving our regular listeners an update on the dream house. I'm sure they're wondering.
Well, we had an almost catastrophe hating our kitchen this weekend and decided it but before the kitchen went in, so that was good, but it was very stressful on me. But it's catastrophe averted. Now I'm back to loving it, and it's going to be great. So,
yay. Well, good.
Yeah.
That's super.
Yeah.
Well, that's your big thing, and my big thing are the conferences, and I had a great time in Evansville on Thursday, and this week I'll be in Fort Wayne, Indiana on Thursday, and we still have a few spots left, so if you have been wanting to come and you are near there within driving distance, come on, I'd love to have you.
I haven't gotten the Evansville report yet. It was a good
It was a fun day.
Yeah,
yeah, it was a lot of fun. We had a really, really nice showing, really fun time. It's a great day, and I'm hoping this week will be the same in Fort Wayne. And you can find out registration information about that on my website at teachmetotalk.com. And you can click the conferences category, and then I think I've put a little reminder about Fort Wayne up, so it should be the first article in that category and probably the first or second article on the main homepage of the website. So check that out if you are interested. Okay, for today's show, we have several questions from moms from the website that I just picked this afternoon. And so we're just going to run through these, hopefully get all four or five of these done today. What do you think, Kate? You think we can do four or five in one?
I don't think it's likely, but let's give it our best shot.
Oh, way to be optimistic there. Okay, this is from a mom named Maria. And she had written us back in August, maybe. Excuse me. And I think they might have even talked about her little boy briefly. And she sent the initial comment and then a couple of little updates. So let me just read through all of those, and then we'll talk about what she says at the end. First of all, just for history's sake, she says, my son just turned 2 this week. We had him evaluated through early intervention when he was 18 months old and still battling. I was also concerned because he started to walk at 15 months. They used a test called the Battelle Developmental Inventory, in which he scored 78 in the speech area. They told me 80 was considered average. So they put on the report that he has a mild delay in speech. In all other areas, he scored above average over 100, so they recommended speech therapy for only twice a month. He made some progress since we started speech therapy, and I also work with him at home. He knows 13 words, and they're all objects. He gets very excited when he sees these objects and will point and tell us the word. His receptive language skills have always been good. He understands everything we tell him and follows our direction. So, phew, situation number one averted there, like we were talking about catastrophes, when receptive language isn't good. You have more of an issue than when it's just expressive, but so far this little boy seems like it's just expressive. She says, overall, he acts like a regular little boy. I don't notice any odd movements or behaviors. My problem is that he still struggles to talk. I work very hard with him to get him to tell me what he wants. He also doesn't string two words together. My mother told me that I really didn't start talking until I was 3 and that my son could be a late talker. The speech therapist taught him a couple of signs he can use, and he does use them, but he doesn't talk to express his needs, and I'm wondering if he will always have to do this to communicate with me and when he will begin talking back to me. Okay, that was number one. Number two The second comment, she said, just thought I'd give you an update. Yesterday during speech therapy, the speech therapist pointed out that my son is tongue-tied, so we made an appointment with the ENT. I remember I had lots of trouble with breastfeeding and asked the pediatrician if his tongue was normal, and the pediatrician said he was fine, so I didn't think about it again until now. After the speech therapist told me that, I played a game with my son pulling out tongues, and sure enough, his tongue was unable to move past his teeth or touch the top of his mouth. So then she writes back like 2 weeks later and says, okay, we just saw an ENT who would not clip his tongue. He told us being tongue-tied has nothing to do with his speech delay, so I'm confused. The SLP thinks we should clip the tongue, and the ENT doesn't think it's necessary. And again, she writes, so now I'm confused. Boy, I would be confused, too, if I were a mom, depending on these two professionals to talk to me about what we should do about this one little boy, and they're getting conflicting reports about what to do. I would think that the speech pathologist, let's see, it said that she thought he was tongue-tied because he couldn't move his tongue out past his teeth or touch the top of his mouth. And usually the guideline with that is that you can stick it out beyond your lips. But honestly, we don't really even have our tongues outside our mouths to talk. So even using that as a guide, there must be a reason for the speech pathologist, though, to think that. But apparently the ENT felt like he had enough mobility. So mom can either do two things. She can either get a second opinion with another ENT who might clip his tongue, or secondly, she can just take the ENT's word for it, who probably believes that something's going on that's not related to a physical issue. And that even if he clipped the tongue, somehow he doesn't think that that's going to help this little boy. And I would think I would, I was going to say I would agree with the ENT in that if he's saying some words and is understood, I would think that this may just end up being an expressive language problem and not a speech intelligibility problem, because if he were, if it was really a case of being tongue-tied, she would see him not being able, trying to talk and then not really being able to, and him being unintelligible, and she doesn't really say anything about that. So I guess I could come down on either side of the fence on this. What do you think about that, Kay?
Way to be nice.
Way to be
all.
Really clear, Laura. Yeah, way to be clear.
What do I think?
We can't see him, so.
Right.
That's
right.
Really hard. And usually if it's, well, and see, I can't even say if a speech pathologist says he's tongue-tied, he probably is, because we both know that there might be some speech pathologist who would want to hope that there's a physiological problem that could just kind of be corrected with a little snip rather than a speech or a language issue. I mean, that it would be really simplistic if that were all it were going to be. But she doesn't say. She does say he struggles to talk. So that makes me wonder what that looks like. If it looks like more like an apraxic thing where he's got some groping, or whether he's really trying to move his tongue to talk. And
ding,
he can't.
Ding, ding,
and again,
we have a winner. That would have been my thing. Yeah, because
I mean, when we read the initial stuff, it sounds like it might be more like apraxia to me than anything else. Is that what you were going to say?
She may be just saying he struggles in that he has not made rapid progress and he still doesn't say very much, and you might say that he struggles to talk, so we shouldn't necessarily read into that. But anytime
it's physical,
anytime I see a child who's two, whose receptive language skills are very good, and he only has, she's 12 or 13 words, and he's had some therapy, and mom's really, really working with him. I think, could be a little apraxia going on here. And, you know, whether or not a speech therapist would agree with that, even on this specific child, is probably somewhat controversial. One might, and the next one might not. A lot of therapists are really conservative about even thinking of two-year-olds in those terms. I'm not qualified to diagnose him, so it doesn't really matter what I think. I just would go about treating him as though he were apraxic, and I suspect he would make faster progress.
That's what I think, too. Mm-hmm. And they're doing the right things by introducing some signs.
Yeah, I would say, you know, she says, again, reading into it, and I may be absolutely reading something into it that's not there, but she says he does a couple of signs. I'd be bumping those signs up right away because it sounds words are very meaningful to him. And some therapists do sometimes go in there and do more and please, more and eat, more and all done. And that's all they do. And I think for all children whose receptive language skills are good, and certainly kids who are struggling to get the words out, bump up the signs. He's ready. He should be. He sounds like a candidate who could be using lots of signs, and not that we want him to sign, we want him to talk. But my experience is if you'll really target those signs and increase that ability, lo and behold, the words are building right along with them. And it just sounds like maybe the therapist is one of those who doesn't really, she gives them a few functional signs, and then that's where they stop. And I've seen these kids, and I find that if you keep pushing the signs and you keep pairing them with the words, they're going to get signs or words much more quickly. And I really believe, and Laura, this may be my own personal theory, so I'm not sure the podcast is the place to discuss it. But
oh, go ahead. Just put it out there.
I believe, and I've told parents this before, I'm not sure it's really technically accurate, but it seems to be true as far as the results. I think that working on signs, I think of it this way. Apraxia is a motor planning speech issue where kids have the words in their head, they have the concept, they understand words generally, at least in its purest form, that's apraxia. They just can't see, they don't have a connection to the wiring circuitry in their brains is kind of faulty as it relates to getting their mouths and jaw and tongue to do what they have to do to say the words. And so, that's motor planning. How are you going to do that? Most kids by 18 months, it's there. It's almost as instinctive for them as it is for us. But apraxic kids, they have the word. They just don't have any plan for how you get your mouth to do what you want it to do. And I think if you push them on signs and you practice, because that's fine motor, motor planning. How do you sign more? How do you sound eat? How do you sign go? They're having to exercise and further develop that part of their brain, that motor planning part, and that naturally helps the speech part. So I think it also...
I totally agree.
Okay. So it's not just my theory? Well, good.
I so wish I could give you credit for that, but I'm afraid that's probably
factual.
Other people would actually agree with you on that. So, and I'm not sure that you're the first person to think of it in that way. But I totally agree. It helps them access those words, and they've got to get to it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so signing's going to help that get better and better and better. And I think the whole he struggles to talk and looks tongue-tied, that could be just looking at him trying to grope and physically not be able to put his tongue in the right place. And so they've looked at it from a physiological standpoint. Oh, he must have restricted movement. Mm-hmm. And the ENT might have said, no.
Looks okay to me.
Especially if he's not having him try to talk. Especially if he's having him try to do, little range of motion kinds of things. And the ENT said, nope, that's not it. So it does kind of lead you to believe that it is more of a verbal apraxia. And what you said about a lot of speech pathologists not wanting to call a child apraxic really is from the, oh my goodness, one day I am going to learn the name of this organization. But the it's from apraxia-kids.org, but it's the North American Suspected Childhood Apraxia of Speech Organization, or I don't know, I'm really butchering that name. But anyway, they really want us to say that children are suspected to be apraxic until they're after 3. And so that has made lots of speech pathologists just throw their clinical judgment out the window and say, well, I can't even think about that until he's 3, when that, in my opinion, is ridiculous. Because if a child is exhibiting those characteristics verbally and even the nonverbal kinds of things, when you see the groping, when you see that there might just be, he's screwing up the vowels, when there's a limited consonant repertoire, all those things that we use to clinically diagnose apraxia, when those things are there, they don't magically just appear on the day of your 3rd birthday and they call you apraxic. You can notice those things. You can see those things when a skilled clinician is looking at that. So, again, if you want to just throw the little word suspected in front of apraxia, you're totally covered from a professional liability standpoint. But at the same time, if it looks like it to you, you need to be treating it like it's a motor speech problem so that the kid gets better. And so many times it's the apraxic kids that aren't severely apraxic, just those mild to moderately apraxic kids that you can have phenomenal success with.
Oh, absolutely.
If you get in there. Yeah, yeah.
I have one
on
my caseload right now who's finally taking off. Boy, he was slow to sign and slow to talk, and when it finally clicked, it's like, hallelujah, it's all working. And he's a great example of that motor planning piece finally clicking in. I mean, he's not talking the way I would like him to, but he has made great progress in the last, like,
right.
6 weeks. You know, just shoo, all of a sudden it all
uh-huh.
came together. And he was a bad signer in the beginning. I mean, it took me a long time to get him, like, probably four and a half months to get him really signing.
And that's how you know that it was really motor planning, because not
mm-hmm.
only does he have verbal motor planning difficulties, he also has kind of global motor planning difficulties.
Right.
Those little hands couldn't really do it either.
Which a lot of times is the case. Not always.
Yeah,
I
not always.
I mean, when I suspect, and I only ever get to suspect since I'm a DI, but when I highly suspect that a child is apraxic, I almost half expect them to not be great signers because it's
right.
motor planning. I mean, occasionally
right.
I'll get one who is a good signer, and I think, well, you know, that part is functioning pretty well, but still doesn't take away from. I mean, I always, whenever I have a kid whose receptive language skills are good, and even simple things like you noted the vowel thing, you know, everything comes out da, everything comes out ma,
mm-hmm.
And other things like. Simple things like trying to get them to open their mouths, trying to get them to stick out their tongue, trying to get, yeah, just simple little things that, you know, 9, 10, 12-month-olds do great, and here they are too, and they can't even.
They can't do it.
They can't even open their mouths. I mean, the weird thing about it is they can't open their mouths when they want to, when they're doing something.
When it's reflexive.
Right.
When it just kind of happens. But when it's under their volitional control, meaning that you want them to imitate or do it on your command, that's when it's hard.
That's when
Not
they
when
struggle.
It's just kind of happened. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But also the kids, and this kid was one, that little boy that I said finally taken off, that whole pop-out word concept with the apraxic kid. Marie doesn't say anything about her little guy, but I wonder if he's mm-hmm. a kid who just on rare occasions will pop out you know, a strange word or a phrase, and they think, where in the world did that come from?
I know.
This little guy, months ago, really hadn't been in therapy very long, 6 or 8 weeks, and he was at the store with his family, and his sister saw a piranha in the fish tank and said it was a piranha, and he popped out, piranha! And, you know, he didn't pop out really
right.
anything, but piranhas were cool, and if you knew this guy, you'd understand why piranhas are cool. But
right.
I wonder if Maria's little boy, any of that, you know, there are others. You have articles on your website about apraxia.
Right.
She used to check those out and see if she thinks, yeah, now this really kind of describes my child. And as far as
right.
the whole tongue-tied thing, you know, I haven't really had too many ENTs who have questioned
I haven't either. I've never had anybody that, even at getting your tongue clipped is not a recommendation that I make routinely to children, but anytime just in a history, I've never even heard of an ENT who refused to do it.
No, I know. Normally they, I mean, I think it's an outpatient. They do it with a little local anesthetic and they snip it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is really
mm-hmm.
not. But for whatever reason, she happened to go to an ENT who didn't feel that was necessary. And he may well be right.
He may be, yeah.
Yeah, he may well be. To me, it's kind of like one of those things, well, it's a pretty easy fix. And
right.
wouldn't you feel silly if you did a year of therapy and found out all he needed was a snip-snip and it was going to be that much easier for him? Do I believe
mm-hmm.
that's it? No, not really.
I don't really believe that's
no.
it either. And
no.
because the ENT, if he, it just seems like you're saying, if he even thought it, he would just go ahead and do it because it is kind of a right
I mean,
there,
you know,
easy
every
little thing to
different,
do.
But here, most
yeah.
of them that I've had any dealings with through families, that they don't really balk at the suggestion to look at it. And if they think, yes, it is, then they snip it whether they think it really is inhibiting the speech or not. You know, they don't act like it's a big deal. A lot of times they'll do it if a kid's getting tubes put in anyway. Hey, you know, but I've seen kids a day or two after, and they don't seem to be in any discomfort at all.
They're fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, and most of the time, I will say, when kids have had it done and been on my caseload, again, I have to tell the moms, well, it wasn't really that, was it?
Yeah.
You know, and again, in a kinder, nicer way than that.
Yeah.
But, you know, after a while, and you're seeing a mom every week, and you're talking and talking and talking. So that kind of comment to some moms right now listening may seem kind of insensitive, but after I've built a relationship with a mom and she knows I want the best for her kid almost as much as she does, and we've had lots of frank and open discussions about what it could be, and it, usually I'm saying, well, if you want to get his tongue clipped, go ahead, but I really think we're okay, you know, which has happened several times. And it's not always a quick fix. It's not always the reason, and it would seem to me that that's what the ENT is thinking too, like, that's not
probably
it.
Probably not, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I would encourage this mom, Maria, to get your teach me to talk with apraxia and other phonological disorders if she doesn't already have it, because those are the techniques that I use day in, day out with kids I suspect are apraxic, and they work really, really well. So I think, you know, maybe she's doing very similar things already. Maybe she's not. I think when you look at a child and suspect they're apraxic and you use those specific techniques, for apraxic kids, they normally respond better than they do than if had you not used them. I mean, I've come in on kids where I was just the DI and the kid wasn't really making much progress with the speech therapist, and I go in and say, I suspect he's apraxic, maybe even only to myself. But when I implement those strategies during sessions and encourage parents to do them, boom, they usually make a lot faster progress. So they need additional help that kids who aren't apraxic don't really need.
Right.
I find the techniques helpful for lots of kids, really, but certainly apraxic kids. So if she doesn't already have that, she needs to invest in the DVD and implement those strategies that you talk about, using the sound cueing strategies. And I don't want to go into your strategies, but there are a lot of good things that she teaches through the DVD how to use. And I think if she isn't already working those into her home therapy sessions, if she did, she could bump those words up.
I think so too. And really, and your advice too about pushing the signing, I would do that. The other thing I would do that she mentioned is she said he doesn't string two words together. Stop even trying to get that right now. He needs to have a solid single word vocabulary. 35 to 50 words, and apraxic kids usually err more on the larger vocabularies toward the 50 words before they're able to start to do those two word combinations. So you may be frustrating him even more than is necessary. So stop working on those phrases and just stick to those single words.
Yeah, just think, build that vocabulary to 40 plus words,
and then you'll get the phrases.
Then we'll cross your fingers it's not hard to get them to the two word phrase level, because sometimes it's a stretch for, you know, that's, Laura talks about sequencing sounds and sequencing words, and that's quite a bit harder when you start combining the words, and you have good articles on your website about trying to get him to use phrases, but at this point it's premature. He really needs to have 40 plus words before he's even ready to go there.
Exactly. And you, the DVD also walks you through that process for kids who have a pretty large single word vocabulary and you can't quite get to phrases. There's some in-between steps you can do too. So take a look at the DVD, and that will get you going in the right direction. And email us back and let us know how he's doing, because I would suspect that he will take off if you implement those things. All right, let's move on to question number two during my quest to get done with all of these during the show.
So far, we're way behind. But that was an interesting question, and we hope to hear back from Maria about how it played out. But that would be my read from what she tells us.
Right. Okay, here's another one. This is just a comment. I think this is actually the third kind of question I sent you, Kate, but it's sort of related to this one because the Maria, the mom that just wrote us the comment, said that her mother said she didn't start talking until she was three and that maybe her son is just a late talker. And certainly when you have a history, a family history of late talking, you know, again, I believe that there's a neurological reason for that, and again, there's a little glitch or a little deficit there that may not prevent a child from talking forever, just to be a little later to get that going, whether it's neurological immaturity or whether, again, it's just, for lack of a better word, a glitch. So here's a comment that's kind of related to that. My mother-in-law, a kindergarten teacher, speaks often on how her boys, now in their early 30s, were slow speakers. In fact, her son is now 32, did not speak until he was 3-ish. When asked why he didn't speak, he said, "I didn't have anything to say." He does not have autism or any other learning disability. Very typical, funny father-husband. You know, late talking does kind of run in families, and whether it's because the child is has difficulty with motor planning, which is, again, I kind of err on the side of that, or whether it's a phonological disorder, you know, again, just from a, let's see, not a cognitive perspective, but just to organize language is a little harder. It takes a little longer for that to get going and put those sounds in the right places. You know, again, that does tend to run in families, for lack of a better way to say that. And so I would suspect that that's what Tiffany, who commented about that on the website, and I guess she was just reading about that. She doesn't say that she has a child that's slow to speak now. She doesn't imply that. I guess she just had nothing better to do and was just searching about late talking. But again, late talking is something that we hear in that children that we might see in our caseloads, their moms or dads or siblings or grandfathers or whoever, you know, sometimes that there really is a pretty strong family history there. Does that mean that we don't give kids therapy now because dad didn't talk till he was three and he's fine? Absolutely not. We do lots of things now that we didn't do 20 and 30 years ago. So if that was Tiffany's point, that she didn't think that children need therapy, they can just wait, I would tell her that she is barking up the wrong tree as far as we're concerned, because early intervention certainly works. I mean, we would want to get there, in there, and give a child help at two just to make sure that he wasn't one of those children that, that might naturally catch up on his own without any kind of intervention, because wouldn't it be terrible if moms waited until three or four thinking that something was going to happen when they lose all those valuable months of intervention, when those little brains are growing more rapidly than they'll ever grow the entire rest of their lives. So thanks,
I also
Tiffany.
Think, in addition to the rapid growth brain development is the social aspect. And I think a lot of kids, particularly, you know, when they get to be around two and if they're fairly language delayed, a lot of times you see a lot of negative behavior associated with it because they're by nature and developmentally appropriate, very independent and want autonomy and freedom and some say over their worlds. And if you don't have any words, you know, a lot of times those kids tend to be fairly demonstrative, what shall we say, in a pleasant way. they can be pretty darn frustrated by not being able to express themselves. And I think, oh, my gosh, for a year and a half, 2 years, you allowed that kid to be locked in his little body without a way to express himself when there's some pretty easy things you could do to help him or her.
Right.
So, you know, I think socially that's kind of a sad. I also think that by the time a kid is three or four, they're pretty aware oftentimes that they really are willing to talk, and that makes it worse and not better. You know, I mean, that can make it worse. So better to address it,
too,
when they're not so aware that they're different than when they're three and a half or four, and they know.
I know, and it's just a myth, really, that some kids don't say anything and then they wake up talking in complete sentences. You may hear a mom say that sporadically, but in real life, that really doesn't happen. I mean, that really doesn't happen. And I'll have a kid on my caseload 1 week is silent, and the next week I get back, he's talking in sentences. So if you're a mom and kind of waiting for that to happen because dad didn't talk until later or whatever, I would highly, highly encourage you to go ahead and pursue speech therapy anyway. Most of the time, it's a lot of fun. You're going to learn lots of fun things to do with your child and, again, give him a way to communicate so that he's not so frustrated, not so socially isolated like Kate referred to. And it is kind of humorous when this person said that the dad said, "I didn't have anything to say." Well, that's fine to say when you're in your 30s about when you were three, but does he really remember that? Probably not. So I think that was kind of a funny thing for them to report. I doubt he said that at three, that he reported it that way. So, again, if you're just crossing your fingers hoping it's going to happen, I wouldn't put all my faith on that, on it working out quite that way. I'd go ahead and do therapy too. Make sure that you're doing everything as a mom, because I can't, you know, all the guilt we feel as moms, anyway, most of the time it's self-imposed, but can you imagine waiting and waiting and waiting and just hoping speech is going to, and language is going to fall into place, and then it not falling into place again, and like you said, Kate, all that wasted opportunity. So just wanted to talk about that a little bit today. We haven't talked about that in a while, so
no.
If you're on the fence about whether to do therapy or not, do therapy. Get your child evaluated. Do the things that we talk about here on the show. Certainly, if you're interested in looking at the DVDs and implementing those things at home, that's fantastic. Children whose parents buy into that make much faster progress than children whose parents don't work with them at all. But it still, in my opinion, warrants a professional assessment so that you rule out anything else that might be contributing to that developmental delay. Anything else you want to say about that one, Kate?
No. I like your point about ruling out anything else, because sometimes we do, well, not infrequently, I guess I would say. I get kids whose parents are primarily concerned about talking, about expressive language skills, and it's not uncommon to get in there and find out that there might be a little bit more going on here than that. And so even though 99% of all parents think it's that, whether it is just that or that plus some underlying cognitive or developmental or other diagnoses that coexist with the late talking. Mm-hmm. So I think parents, you know, think of it in those terms, but it's not always just that. So great idea to get an evaluation and rule out some other things.
Exactly. All right. Let's move on to the next one. This is by a mom named Chris. Actually, I don't know. It could be a mom or a dad. That name kind of goes either way. And she or he. Let's just say Chris, a parent named Chris. Chris says.
Yeah.
I'm in a silly mood today.
Chris says. What does Chris say, Laura?
The parent, Chris, says, "Help, I believe my 2-year-old may be autistic. Where to begin? He only says 2 words, bye and hello, although he is working on outside. He will pace back and forth like a cat looking at a table or a wall. He organizes his toys constantly and gets upset if one of them is moved or falls off the couch. He's very picky about food to the point that he won't eat for 12 to 16 hours unless he gets the food he wants. He will play, but it's usually by himself, looking at books, playing with a musical toy, or organizing. His motor skills seem to be okay, as he runs, throws, and climbs about as well as our 3-year-old. He babbles constantly, but not many words. He does respond to his name, looks directly at you, and responds to smiling and frowning. What should I do?" Chris, I think you're on the right track with wanting to go ahead and rule out a social communication disorder or autism, because there are certainly several red flags in what this parent, Chris, has reported, because he is 2 and not talking. He certainly probably has some sensory issues that we see with children who go on to be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, in that he likes to line up those toys, as Chris says, organizes, but I would suspect that it's lining up. Also, those food aversions are really common, and feeding issues common in our little friends that go on to be diagnosed with autism. She said that he does play by himself, and he likes to look at books, which usually means there's heightened visual awareness there, and we certainly see that in children who do go on to get that diagnosis. But my big point about this is it really doesn't matter if he is or isn't on the spectrum, we know that he's language delayed, because a two-year-old should have many, 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 many more words than bye and hello. So at the very least, she's looking at language delay here. She says that he responds to his name and looks directly at them and responds to smiling or frowning, but she really doesn't say anything, or he or Chris doesn't say anything else about how the son's receptive language may be, as in following directions and following routines. And I would suspect that that probably is delayed too, because the absence of any comment about that. So I would certainly beg you to go ahead and get him assessed by your state's early intervention program, which runs until he's three, and you can have someone take a look at him. And again, regardless of whether he gets an autism diagnosis or not, there's certainly a language delay, and he needs to be working on improving that language.
I totally agree, Laura. You know, there are definitely some red flags there that early interest in books. I wonder how this child does when Chris tries to read to him, because a lot of times those early interest in books kids, not always, because certainly there are very typical kids who love books very early, but when a parent tells me a child who has these other kind of red flag behaviors, oh, he really likes to read, and if I probe into that at all and say, well, will he let you read him a story? A lot of times the answer is, and I don't mean, you know, Little House on the Prairie kind of story, just whatever they're into.
Good Night Moon.
Yeah, a little kids, a little two-year-old kind of book. And it's not uncommon for parents to say, well, no, he gets kind of mad. He wants to hold it. He wants to turn the pages. He, you know, and then I suspect, well, you know, that's not the same as a kid who loves to read, in my mind. That's a kid who loves to hold and manipulate the books, but not so much an interest, a typical interest in books for that age. So I'd be wondering about that. Those red flag behaviors, those are all reasons for concern, I think, and I'm with you about how are his receptive language skills. I get that he makes eye contact, responds to his name fairly well, and those are good signs. However, in my mind, they don't necessarily rule out autism, nor do the atypical behaviors or the behaviors she describes about looking at the table and looking at things. Those don't necessarily demand a diagnosis,
right.
But, you know,
right.
All of them are things that I would be thinking, need to look into this, need to find out more. I would say this because I've gotten fairly outspoken about this, even in the trenches, about discouraging parents from allowing too much time with things like those music toys, you know, TV. This is not a child I would want watching very much TV at all, particularly if he has older brothers and brothers always watching whatever, Thomas, or, you know, whatever cool show he likes. These kids a lot of times can be very absorbed in television, and I would really not want to see that. So just from what they write about the music toys, you know, he's into that, I'd be saying, nah, that's not so great. He needs to be engaged, so that he's not engaging in those atypical behaviors that kind of are, you know, his preoccupation at this point. So definitely get him evaluated from the early intervention system. I'd also wonder, how social is he with them? And that's
right.
Something that parents don't always understand either, because a lot of times kids who can have some spectrum-y behaviors are, in a way, very attached to their parents, but yet their social responses aren't really typical either, and parents don't always make a distinction between, well, he loves me to death, he won't leave my side, whenever we go anywhere, he wants to cling to me, he comes to me for comfort, and those are all very real signs of attachment, but the kind of social things we look at may not be intact, even if those things are.
Right, and sometimes there's a qualitative difference that it's really difficult to recognize when you're so subjective about your own kid and your own baby that you just adore more than life itself. And so sometimes it's hard for you to see those things. Again, eye contact to one mom may not be eye contact to another mom. mm-hmm. or looking at him or responding to smiling or frowning. It could be that, again, he responds really when mom is smiling and playing those high-energy games but doesn't get much in the way of everyday conversation. Or he might understand when mom is super-duper mad but doesn't really, again, kind of understand that normal back-and-forth conversation that you have all day. And so, again, I would really question that receptive language, too, and just say that so many of these things that we talk about with those social skills and that interactive piece, sometimes there's, again, just a real difference that it's difficult to see if he's your own baby that you love and adore. And so having a professional kind of come in and look at that from a more objective place, and again, I think as early interventionists, we all want the best for the kids that we see. We all, or most of us anyway, I think, love children. That's why we do these jobs. And if, don't get me started on the ones that don't even like kids. You know, why are you doing this anyway? But just to get a professional opinion, I think, is a good idea. I'm glad, though, that Chris was on the website and obviously searching for things and answers. So I hope that Chris will continue to read the articles that are there. And there's so much new stuff on that you have to really kind of dig back to those older articles. Flip back a few pages at the bottom. It'll say, at the bottom of any page of a category, it says older entries. Click all the way back to the beginning because those are where the really basic how-to articles are for parents. And the DVDs would be a good idea for Chris's family as well to get an idea of the kinds of things that we do with children when we're working with them to get that language going. But first and foremost, I would suggest a professional evaluation so that you know what you're dealing with.
Okay, I guess we should... You should interject. I will interject. Chris may not know upon initial evaluation he's autistic. He's not autistic. He's
right.
He will have a much better, Chris will have a much better idea about, well, how are his receptive language skills? How are his expressive language skills? How does he respond socially? Does this therapist think that's fairly typical?
Right.
You know, those sorts of things. So we don't mean to say that they'll get one evaluation and the child will be diagnosed with autism or won't be, or that'll be ruled out.
Right.
That's probably further on down the road if, you know, they start the process and the child doesn't make what is considered to be decent or typical progress, they may suggest that they take the child to a group of experts or to a psychologist to have further testing, because typically that's how kids are most often diagnosed with autism. But at least they'll have a lot more pieces of the puzzle and hopefully have good ideas about how to address it right now. Because, you know, one of my ongoing mantras is, diagnosis or not, it's still the same problems, whether it's enough to be a diagnosis or not enough to be a diagnosis. And I totally understand that that's hugely important to parents, but the problems, whether they're real or not or significant or not, are there whether there's a diagnosis or not. So, I mean, there is enough in what Chris says about this child to make me really concerned as far as the atypical behaviors, very limited use of speech. I would say, you know, now's the time. He's two. Start the process. Get the assessment. Get him some ongoing therapy.
Because at the very least, he will qualify. He's going to qualify for speech. He's language delayed. I mean, that's a given. So he's going to qualify for services. So I think that's great
and
advice.
In some states, there's a fairly long waiting list. So it may not be an immediate, even though in theory there's not a waiting list anywhere. In reality, some places have some pretty significant waiting lists. So as far as getting the evaluation and then getting ongoing therapy. So start it and, you know, call Monday morning, tomorrow morning, get a call into your early intervention program. Some people do screenings now over the phone. Just be honest with what you're seeing and what you're not seeing, and I trust that the child will be evaluated and will qualify. And then look at Laura's website thoroughly. Read those early articles. There's lots of relevant stuff there that can get this parent started. And then also, I guess start with Teach Me to Talk, just your kind of basic first DVD,
approach.
Laura.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
I think that's good advice.
Yeah. Set the stage, so. But now's the time. There's a reason for concern. It's legitimate, so you need to get moving on it.
Yeah, and if a parent doesn't know how to contact your state's early intervention program, you can Google your state name plus the phrase early intervention and usually be able to dig through those first few options that come up in the responses and be able to get a phone number so that you can call and talk with a person about how to get your child referred. And a parent can do that directly. You do not have to have a physician to do that. So I hope Chris will follow our advice.
Word or not, just go ahead and call and get the ball rolling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even in Kentucky where there's not a horrible, there's certainly a short supply of speech therapists, but I don't think we compare to some other states where I've had parents move. And no, I mean, it can be 3, 4, 5, 6 months to get therapy going. And we're not nearly that bad here, so we don't know where this parent is. Doesn't really matter. I mean, to me,
it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Two.
Well,
is old enough to start addressing what the parent's concerned about, because those are very legitimate concerns.
Yeah, absolutely. So I hope Chris will follow through with that. Okay, our last one. We have 13 minutes for this question. This mom says, and I do not have the mom's name.
Just don't say Pat.
It's me. I believe it's mob, so I don't know. Now I'm going to be freaked out about that.
The whole time.
Okay, here we go. The site is very helpful. I found it last week and plan to visit it many more times in the future. Here's my question. My daughter is 25 months old and is being raised three-lingual. First of all, I would say, oh, my goodness, we've got to do something about that. My native language is Serbian, father is French, and in preschool she started a month ago, it's English. I believe she's a bit slower on the language development than I would expect. Well, first of all, she's going to be slower because she's not learning one language. She's learning three languages, and so that complicates things, you know, triple complicates it. So not only is she struggling, part of the reason probably is because, she's not just learning one language. She says she did meet the two-year milestones with 50 words and combining two words together like 4 days before her second birthday. I took her for evaluation in early prevention, which concluded she is developing exactly for her age. And usually that just means that you've met those minimum requirements for a child. And the truth is, the baseline milestones that we use in early intervention, children with typically developing language, children that are doing well with language, blow those away. So when we have a child that's just barely keeping up, I have a really hard time saying that they're doing fine. I mean, this mom is wording it and saying she still looks a little bit slow to me, even though she's meeting what those minimum milestones are. And I think the mom is right to be concerned. She says, where I'm a little concerned is that I'm not seeing any meaningful two-word phrases. Usually it's bye-bye something, like mama, house, dogs, car, depending on the situation, but not like give me milk or cheese. I also noticed lately she's repeating the last word in the question, especially if it's a new word and she's never heard it before, or a super familiar sentence. When I say, do you want milk, she says milk instead of yes. However, 60% of the question, I would get a clear no or an ah, which is a version of yes. When I would correct it and say, we don't say ah, but she will always fill in the blank, smile, and say yes. She says she does this in all three languages, so wow, that's great. I did not hear why or who questions yet. The teacher in school believes that she is where she's supposed to be for her age, but she also pointed out that she hears repeating of the words like come inside, and she would repeat inside then, but not after again. However, she believes this is normal and that it's progress within the next several months that's critical. Apart from that, I don't see any other indications that anything else is out of order. Her motor skills are very good, great eye contact, smiling, trying to sing, and trying to count in all three languages, usually just some numbers, not all. What's your advice? Am I expecting a bit too much from a 25-month-old? I'm just comparing her with a 25-month-old that already asks why questions and combined three words in the phrase. I do think that the three languages is probably preventing this little girl from a adding more phrases because, again, it's triply complicated for her. She's not just learning one language. She's learning it in all three. And we know that children who are raised in these bilingual and trilingual homes do are slower to meet those milestones and do have a harder time expressively, at least in meeting where other peers are that are just learning one language. So I certainly understand this mom's concern.
Laura, although I'm going to weigh in on this one and say I'm not terribly concerned about this child. I suspect this is one of those cases where this is more a result of having lots of languages going on. And
to learn.
Right. That's not uncommon for those kids to be a little bit late, and she is not off the charts behind. She's a little bit late, in my opinion.
Right.
So, you know, probably that's what's going on here.
A lot of the things that she's describing that she wants her to do, like give me milk, give me cheese, she's just not quite there yet. She's using those really early phrase combinations like bye-bye, whatever, and that tells us that she has just started to combine phrases. Those other phrases probably will come, but I will tell Mom that the best thing they could do really probably right now is pick one language and kind of focus on that and then let her kind of catch up. And she does say that she's using and understanding all three of those languages. So like you, it's not a big, terrible delay or anything that looks like long-term it could set her up for any kind of academic failure or anything like that. But if Mom wants to see faster progress with something, she probably could slow it down a little bit with at least a couple of the languages, and she might see some better.
I wonder if they
progress.
Live. Kind of makes me think they might live in the United States because she talks about early intervention, but maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
Well, you know, this is the advice that I give about this, and again, lots of research says that if a child's going to be language delayed, he's going to be language delayed regardless of how many languages he hears at the beginning. But what we tell parents to do, and this mostly applies to parents with children with receptive language delays, meaning that they have difficulty understanding language, is to pick one language and stick to it. But this mom, to me, seems like she's so overly concerned that she may be driving her little girl crazy with pushing her forward. So what I would say then is pick one language. If you're going to push, just pick one. Just pick one. It doesn't even matter to me, you know, which one it is. I would think English would be the most necessary, though, since that's the language of school. And so just pick one of those and kind of see what happens if you just simplify everything that's going on with her, meaning that you're just going to focus on one language. But again, it doesn't seem like there's a huge, huge delay here. But I do think that for this mom and this little girl's sanity, that it might be better served if they save all three of the languages for when she's just a little bit older and has one as kind of her foundational language and uses the others to kind of layer on that and relate to that. But a lot of speech pathologists would really disagree with that. But anytime I think we have a kid at two that's struggling a little bit, if we can simplify, it's going to instantaneously get easier. And so to just go with one language right now would probably be what an intense mom should do with a little girl who might be struggling a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's just my opinion.
And I tend to agree. To me, it just kind of makes sense. But like I said, from the beginning, you know, if everything she says is true, probably it's the result of hearing all the languages and she's struggling to keep up expressively.
To me,
always the most important thing is how are the receptive language skills? Sounds like they're pretty darn good.
Yeah,
so.
And she's got a preschool teacher, too, that's saying, oh, everything she seems to be doing seems to be just normal with what we would expect. So she's had lots of people tell her not to worry. So it does sound like it's just a really on-the-ball kind of type A intense mommy here wanting to move things along a little bit. You know, and we all want our kids to be way ahead of where they should be because just naturally, instinctively, you know, we all have dreams when our children are born that they're going to be, you know, really good looking and academically successful, and you know, some parents dream of having huge athletic ability and those things, and so it's hard when some of those things don't seem to be falling into place, although, again, this little girl doesn't seem delayed by, I mean, that would even be a stretch to use that word at all.
Right.
I mean, she's meeting those minimal milestones. But again, mom is looking at other children who are doing really, really well with language and are using longer phrases and asking some questions. And so she's seeing that. And, it's, you know, it made me wonder if all the kids in her preschool come from bilingual or trilingual environments, or if most of them were just with one language. And so naturally they're going to be a little bit ahead expressively because they haven't had so much to sort out. And so mom can't even really compare her little girl to those kids because, again, you know, different kinds of circumstances
French, English,
there.
French, English, and Spanish. Or what was it?
Serbian.
That's right. Serbian, English, and French. So,
but that's a lot.
We don't know where she lives or what the situation is.
Right.
But, yeah, that's my read on that one.
Yeah. But she really could probably the first thing to do would be to relax a little bit and not put so much pressure because it does sound like she's really trying to keep up. But
right.
I do understand her concern because you do start to kind of think, okay, her friends are doing it. I'm hearing more language from her other friends. What's going on? I don't want her to be behind. What can I do? Come on here. You know, I'm that kind of mom too. So I totally get that. So one thing she could do is simplify. And it would probably be a little easier. And it sounds like mom is, well, we know mom is bilingual because her native language is Serbian and she has great English, you know, that she's communicating in here too. So I'm sure that's important to the mom and she's wondering why it's not coming as easily as she would hope.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's always kind of hard to tell people to limit the exposure to multiple languages because parents love that, and if it's their native language, of course, you understand why they, and their, you know, their
right.
family speaks it, and they want their kids to speak it.
And you
want to
hold
get
on to
all
that.
Yeah. But on the other hand, in this case, not, I don't feel as strongly. In cases where there's clearly a receptive issue as well, then I
right.
really feel strongly that the exposure to multiple languages needs to be significantly reduced until the child's receptive language skills or at or very close to age level. And this girl
right.
sounds like her receptive skills are, so I don't feel as strongly, but I think if she wants to see more progress with her expressive skills, then she needs to reduce the exposure to all the languages and it'll come along. But do I think it's a huge deal? No, probably not.
Probably not. I think you're right about that. But mom can simplify, and I think it'll make it better. And if mom feels strongly about not simplifying, oh, well, just wait it out because it probably will turn out absolutely fine regardless.
Right.
So that's that. Okay, we got finished with all the questions today with 2 minutes left. Can you believe that?
Well, that was pretty good. I doubted us. That might be a first, Laura.
I know, and I do think I picked questions that we didn't have to labor over, and sometimes it does seem like we're talking about lots of the same things, but I think that means that just lots of moms have the same concerns. So we are happy to, again, address these things as they come in, and if you have a question you would like for us to talk about, please, please, please call us and ask us yourself. We love to get live callers, and maybe
well,
we haven't gotten
one. Make it easier
one,
on people if we didn't change the time every other week.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. So next week, plan a call is 6 p.m. Eastern time. And the call-in number, if you want to write it down today so you can have all week to get ready for your call, is 1-718-766-4332. If you want to give us some advanced warning of what your questions will be, although we are fine to just fly by the seat of our pants like we do most of the time anyway, you could call us or just like that, or you could email us first, and you can send that to Laura@teachmetotalk.com, and I will forward that to Kate, and we will pre-plan, at least a little bit anyway, pre-read your questions, and then talk about that next week. But we would absolutely love for some moms to call. And if you have submitted a comment or a question on the website and I have been slower to get to that, resubmit it and say that you would like for us to discuss that on the podcast because those are the moms that we really, really want to help, the moms that pursue us with those questions. And I, like I said last week, I've not been as quick to respond to comments on the website as I have been in the past because I am just super, super, super busy. But hopefully some of that will settle down and I'll get back to my established somewhat of a normal routine about responding.
Well, we love to hear from parents and or therapists if you have a child you're working with and would like to share the situation and discuss it amongst peers. Call us or email us, and we'll give it a shot.
Sounds great. All right. Talk to you next week.
Okay. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.